ladies and gentlemen, this is the Above the Bar podcast, a show about a middle-aged father, current events, and how these things affect my everyday life. Alrighty, folks, welcome back to the Above the Bar podcast. It's your host, Sean. I know the bar has been open almost every day this week. We've had a busy week, a lot of people to talk to, a lot of things going on, and today is none the different. Anyone that in my age group, if you're in your 40s, 50s, you know Saturday, you had the Saturday night main event. You had Saturday afternoons, Sunday afternoons, NWA, WCW, WWF to WWE, SmackDown, Raw, all the different elements that were out there that made up professional wrestling in the United States. There is no one, and I can't name you a single person on God's green earth as an American who has not at least sat down for a couple of minutes and watched the wrestling match, watch these modern day gladiators make it happen. But at the same time, there was the one guy that we all yelled at and said, turn around, look, don't you see that? Well, today we have one of the legends of that, a gentleman who has written a book called Ring Man. We have Mr. David Dwinell. David, welcome to the bar.
Well, Sean, thank you very much for inviting me on your show this evening, and it's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, we are going to try to get a little bit behind the scenes here with you, find out all the great things that we need to know about with pro wrestling and things that we're missing here and what's, you know, what that world's about. But as always, before we get going too far, we have things we have to do here at the bar. We always got to do the housekeeping as we open the doors. First things first, take a moment. Everyone who's out here watching, listening, make sure you take your time and you go ahead and share this with every single page that you can find, every single person that you know. Put it on your personal page. Call your mom. Tell her to start listening and tune in. Do everything you can and get this thing shared to everybody you know. That way, everybody gets a chance to find out about Dave's book, Ring Man, what that was about. We're also going to be talking about the upcoming inaugural International Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame inductions. We got that coming up here, so we're gonna get this going. Also, as always, over my right shoulder, we have Sticker and a Cause. If you've got something that you believe in, something that you're supporting, and it's got a sticker that's involved with it, make sure you pick up your computer. Nobody calls each other anymore. Pick it up, reach out to me, let me know what it is, and I will absolutely, positively read about that thing on air live so that everybody can find out about it. Everybody can know what that thing is so that they can support it. But now that all the housekeeping is done, let's talk to Dave. Dave, again, welcome. I'm so excited to have you out here.
Was that you in the audience that used to yell at me? I wasn't sure, but you mentioned that you were in the audience yelling at the ref.
I absolutely probably at some point was that kid going, turn around, ref, turn around. He's cheating. He's got the ropes. He's got the ropes.
And if I had, I would have lost my job, you know.
I guarantee you I was that kid. I loved it. I mean, I was talking with some friends that about this and about wrestling and when we were kids and how much we got into it. I can remember, as we're sitting here talking, and I've got my WrestleMania t-shirt on, mm-hmm, with the Ultimate Warrior. I definitely want to hear about that story. But I was always a big fan of those guys. But I think like some of the earliest ones that I remember, I was probably more into the WCW. And you might be able to tell me, because I don't even know. I grew up in Baltimore. So what circuit was that?
Well, you know, I go back a little bit further than you. I go back to the 1950s when you said you got first involved in wrestling. Well, I was a fan. I was a big fan also when TV first came out, and nothing really interested me. And all of a sudden I see the two guys in the middle of a ring beating the crap out of each other. I said, what am I watching? And it turned out to be wrestling from Capital Wrestling from Washington, D.C. And back in the 50s, it was WWWF or Capital Wrestling, and they kind of control the East Coast. They'd go from Washington to Baltimore to Philly to New York, White Plains, where I worked a lot and lived. They'd go up the coast to Boston, Hartford, and up to Maine. So when I was growing up and during the 80s, it was pretty much early 80s. It was pretty much all. I broke it in 1982. It was all WWF. Right. Then when I'm not too sure. At the beginning, I spent my career working from Maine to North Carolina. But in the early days of my career, in a good part of the 80s, I never really got down south very much. And I don't know too much about the WCW or the NWA, but I know the NWA came into New York because of the fact that Vince was going into their territories. So the NWA came into New York, and I worked with them in the early 80s. Jim Crockett promotion came into, it was Mount Vernon, a high school stadium in Mount Vernon. I refereed Superstar Graham against Sam Houston. I refereed Magnum TA against Tully Blanchard. J.J. Dillon against the Italian Stallion. And there was one more match in there. I forget who it was. Myself and Dick Kroll, who was the dean of referees for the WWF back when I had to use state officials like myself. And I was excited about working with the NWA, or if you want to go the precursor of WCW. I was very excited because they were less show and more, I would say, sport than the WWF. So I was very excited about working with them, and I got a great compliment. I'm not trying to brag, but it was a compliment that I got, and I thought it was great. I was always taught when you go down for the count, put your head on the guy's shoulder so you can see it's legitimate pin. And some referees were on the other side of the ring bouncing up and down on their knees and couldn't possibly see. So I went down with my head right there and Sam Houston's shoulders, who was being pinned by Graham. I went 1, 2, and Houston goes, "Wow, a New York ref didn't know how to work." And it's not a knock on the other ref. There were a lot of great refs in New York, but don't get me wrong. But I took that as a great compliment coming from an NWA NWA wrestler. And that was my first experience with them. My second experience was, I don't know if you remember, a USA Pro Wrestling, USA Pro Wrestling came in. It was the, it was like the NWA, WCW, Georgia Championship Wrestling. They put AWA, they put a group of people together to try to combat Vince again, going into their territory when he started in with cable television. And I did one of the second greatest match of my career, my 32-year career, I might say, when I refereed an AWA championship between Nick Bockwinkel, Rick Martel. I mean, if that wasn't an outstanding match to begin with, but in the corner of Bockwinkel was Nature Boy Buddy Rogers.
The original Nature Boy.
The original Nature Boy. And at the end of the match, evidently Bockwinkel's, they tell me, I didn't see it, Bockwinkel's leg was on a rope, but I counted to three. And I got a lot of heat, and I'm arguing with the first WWF champion, and it was one of the greatest experiences of my life. So I do go back a ways with the NWA, WCW, AWA, and there was some great times.
I got chills hearing you, Dave, and you're saying these names because as a kid, you know, these were the guys that in those early 80s days, like I said, I can remember turning on the TV and you didn't know what – I never knew what time these things were going to come on. It wasn't
right, exactly, so, right, 11 o'clock at night.
Right. You know, you're a kid, you're like – I'm in Baltimore, we had on Sundays, you had the Creature Feature Hour, which always played like monster movies. Mm-hmm. And we would get New York 9 down there on our cable. Mm-hmm. So you would get some of the stuff from out of the New York – pieces. We had TNT when that first came out, and Ted Turner had bought the WCW and all the NWA stuff and brought that around. Mm-hmm. So we had that, but I mean, just hearing the names that you're saying are incredible.
Well, it was a great experience. I do want to mention something. I don't want people to think I did not like working with the WWF because of what I said about the NWA. There were two little different products, but my greatest experiences have been with the WWF, working the Garden about 15 times, with tremendous amount of different individuals. And, you know, I didn't have one league. I didn't have one NWA, AWA, WWF. I liked them all. They all had good, great points. They all had phenomenal wrestlers. And, you know, besides them, I did get to work with a tremendous amount of independents. So I've been very fortunate in my 32-year career to be able to just work with 350 named wrestlers and 45 champions.
Well, you say that, and that I think it's an interesting thing, is you use that term named wrestlers. And one of our big fans out there loves the psychology of the referee, Anthony. Anthony's a big wrestling fan. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a great way to put it is, you know, I can remember early on, and you can talk to this. I'd like to hear your thoughts on it. I can remember when the referee was kind of, he was the dolt, for lack of better, in the ring. Like, he wasn't, I don't mean that in a mean way, but he was like the guy who, well, how did you miss that? How did you miss that thing? Like I was saying, as a kid, to it moved on, where they became wrestlers almost. They were hitting moves on people.
Well, let me explain. And maybe the best way to explain this is to, first of all, I think back in the classic of the golden days, the referee had a much more difficult job because kayfabe was fully in. And one of the jobs of the referee was to add realism, enforce the rules. I was broken into by Johnny Rodz. Johnny Rodz was my first match against 21-year-old Eddie Gilbert. And I was told, be the referee, be the sheriff. Keep order. Don't favor the face. Don't favor the heels. Try to work up some heat with us for the audience. Well, my first two shows were, and we can get into this a little bit later. My first two shows were for the WWF in front of 5,000, 6,000 people at the White Plains County Center. And my third show was a show in one of the worst sections of the Bronx. I had never heard two words. I'd never been familiar with these two words in wrestling, independent promotion. Never heard of them. So I show up thinking it's the WWF. It's at the Wakefield Forum. I said, maybe this is like the Montreal Forum, and all of the letters were missing on the marquee. I had to park at the AMP parking lot. I asked some guy, I said, where's it safe to park? He said, about 25 miles up the road. So I'm going, this ought to be good. So I walk in, and a promoter, promoter was very happy to see me. He said, the last show, the referee never showed up. I said, oh my God, he must have been very bright. Because, I mean, there were burnt out buildings. There were people begging us. I said, how the hell could the WWF be running in a place like this? And that's when I learned the words independent promotion. So I walk in the arena, and there's 74 men and 10 women. And the 74 men, 73 were drinking out of brown paper bags. And the wrestlers all spoke Spanish, and I took French in high school, so we had a little bit of trouble communicating. Well, to get back to the idea about the referee, I'm in a ring, and it's a tag team match. And these two fellows, one of them just got out of the hospital because he had groin injury. My back is turned with one of the heels, and my back is turned with the face, one of the guy's partner, and the two heels are working over his groin in the corner. This is a guy who just got out of the hospital from a groin injury, and everybody knows it. People are throwing stuff in the ring. I'm getting bottles are going by my head. You know, I got nervous. So I said, I told the timekeeper, I said, go get the promoter. Well, before the promoter came out, I noticed there's a guy screaming and yelling at me and pointing at me, and he's standing outside the ring. I noticed there's a gun sticking out of his pocket. And I'm going, this is not a good sign. I do not want to die watching 73 people drinking out. My last few moments on earth cannot be watching 73 people drinking out of brown paper bags. So I said to the promoter, I said, would you take the gun away from this guy? I go, he's not dangerous. I know that guy. I go, no, that's not good enough. take the gun away. So he took the gun away, and it was fine. And I, as soon as the show was over, I grabbed my pay, I grabbed the pay envelope, and I walk out, and my car is locked in the parking lot. The fence is closed at AMP. It closed at 11. They told me it closed at 12. So I said, oh, my God. So I asked the guy.
So you're stuck at this point.
What?
You're stuck there at this point.
I asked for the promoter. He sends a guy out with the largest pair of clippers I've ever seen. He clips the lock off. As I'm getting ready to get my car, I said, what's that popping sound? He goes, it's gunfire, but it's only two or three blocks away. You don't have to worry. So I said to myself, wow, this is quite an experience. But the point I wanted to make to your question, and I know it's been a long answer, is people thought it was real. That's why you had that reaction against the referee. And part of the referee was to try to get heat. It was always to try to get heat in the audience, whether you're a wrestler or a referee. And a referee could get some heat, like you said, by not seeing. You really got to work at not seeing.
Wow.
That was a funny. I thought that I'd like to share that with you because it was like, people think of professional wrestling as being all glamorous, but trust me, it wasn't always.
Well, I think that's what we see the modern day pro wrestler. It is very to your point when you said the difference between WWF back in the day and WCW. I'm wearing a WrestleMania shirt with the Ultimate Warrior, formerly the Dingo Kid. It was bright colors. It was fluorescent. It was, cutting a promo, and it was energy. It was very, very high energy in big stadiums. Mm-hmm. WCW still filled those big stadiums, but it always had more of that darker, grittier. It was about the, they were still going to cut a promo on somebody. Nobody cuts one, in my opinion, better than Ric Flair, especially when they were the Four Horsemen
out there.
But you had a different vibe to Claire, that.
Piper was great too.
Oh, Piper in the Piper's Pit.
Mm-hmm.
When he would do those things, just incredible stuff. It's funny you were talking about. So you did the Ultimate Warrior's 10th match ever.
Mm-hmm.
He was still considered
the Dingo Warrior at that point in time. And it was a fair in Rockland County, New York, a small fair. He had just come in and he hadn't even appeared on television yet. And I remember distinctly him running out to the ring at 90 miles an hour. And then he got in the ring and he was kind of gassed. It was grasping for air a little bit. And he wrestled Terry Gibbs. And it was probably only 300-400 people there. But you see, the WWF in those days, they were only on the East Coast to a great degree. And although not maybe at that point in time, but what was happening was, they had to fill in spots for their wrestlers. They weren't the organization you see today worldwide or countrywide. So between those shows I mentioned before in Baltimore and in Boston, they had to find small shows. So they'd go to country fairs. I did a show at Mount Vernon High School. Lou Albano put it on. Actually, people don't realize Lou Albano's father was a famous surgeon. Did you know that?
I had no idea.
And his brother was the principal of a middle school. And then it was Lou.
It was Captain Lou.
And I mean, in the early days in the 80s, these guys had other jobs. Lou Albano used to drive a cab in Mount Vernon in the 80s.
Wasn't George the Animal Steele was like a math teacher?
He coached football at a big high school in Detroit. And he taught. I don't know if it was phys ed or not, but he coached. He taught. And he wrestled with a mask at first. I worked with George a lot. Great, great guy. I said to him, I said, George, how the heck did you last so long in a business? He goes, Dave, I never fell down. I ate turnbuckles. I punched people. And I growled a lot. I never fell down. So he goes, what the heck? My body was never abused. So he goes, stuck my green tongue out. He goes, stuff like that. He goes, I wasn't crazy. I had the best gimmick going. I never got hurt.
Oh, that's so great. And well,
he was a lovable crazy.
He was a lovable crazy.
Yeah. And he was a teacher, and he told me he used to wrestle with a mask when he would only wrestle summers and weekends with a mask. And then they turned him into the Animal. And of course, he came and had great feuds with Bruno Sammartino. And he was quite a character. But they weren't making a lot of money way back in the early 80s. They weren't making, some of the guys worked on the docks out for the New York Post in New York.
You know, and there were still a lot of, and you don't hear this term too much anymore. There were still jabronis back in those days that, you know, they would come into town.
Sinuses, sorry.
It's all good. But they would come into town and they would grab a hold of somebody and say, hey, you know, we need this guy. We need that guy. You know, we need somebody for, you know, you're just going to get tossed around. The one that I remember back home, his name was, either Bob Starr or it was Bob Starr.
Bob Starr, okay.
Yeah, Bob Starr was out of Baltimore. He was one of those guys that he was going to lose. He was there to lose.
Well, they were called, they were referred to as jobbers.
Jobbers.
I when I was a kid, I used to refer to them as cannon fodder. You know, they would come out and just get blown away by, but Vince Sr. and Vince Jr. had wonderful psychological way of running a promotion. They would bring in somebody like Steele or Baron Miguel Cicluna or somebody huge, the mass superstar. And what they would do is they would bring them in and they would blow everybody away on TV for about a month. Then they'd go to the arenas and beat up on the B-type wrestlers, the better wrestlers. And then they'd go into the Garden and finally get a shot with Bruno. And the first shot would be Bruno would get disqualified. The second shot would be stopped on blood. And the third shot would be in a cage. And then they'd leave. And the next one would come in. So there was when I was growing up, there was a little bit of psychology in there. You had to work your way up to get a title shot, which I think gave a more believability to it. You had to be a number one or number two contender to get a title shot. You just couldn't come in out of nowhere and I mean, if you remember, Hulk Hogan just came in out of nowhere and just won a title. And that was kind of it, you know.
He beat Iron Sheik, right?
He beat the Iron Sheik. And nobody – I'm really sorry. I have these dripping sinuses, and it's terrible, especially where I am in Catskill, New York. It's a little bit
– Well, you're just down the road from me.
Where are you?
I'm in Center Brunswick up in by Albany.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah, no, not far – not far apart at all. We retired up here about 10 years ago. But again, McMahon had great psychology back then as far as that was concerned. And the WWF, like you were talking about WCW, the WWF ran small arenas, and they were the most fun. They were so totally fun because the fans were close. There was a closeness. There was a proximity, all of that. It was just a lot of fun.
That's so – I just find it fascinating. Now, to kind of roll back here to, you know, you did this for 32 years to kind of roll back. So you didn't set out to be a pro wrestling referee. You were an official New York State referee, like license or whatever the process is.
Well, I should mention something to you. I never refereed full time. I was not a full time referee. I always had a legitimate job. My first job out of college was teaching, and then I worked in a trade center, and then I ended up being a receiver of taxes for one of the largest towns in New York State, down in Westchester County. And I actually collected the taxes of Arnie Skolin, who lived about 20 minutes from me, Freddie Blassie, who lived about 20 minutes from me, and Paul Heyman's parents, who lived in Scarsdale, but we collected their taxes. So. You know, I always had a legitimate job. I had thought of one time about doing it full time. I mean, I worked full time at refereeing because I traveled weekends with a number of independent organizations. I got shows with the WWF, and I worked I would say maybe 8 shows a month, 9 shows a month, which is not bad for someone who's doing it part time. But I remember I was out one time over at the Nassau Coliseum, and we were on a runway, and I was talking to the chief, who was an agent at the time. And I said, "Chief, I heard you're looking for some refs. What do you think? Maybe should I apply?" He goes, "You got a good job?" I go, "Yeah." "You get pension?" "Yeah." "You get medical benefits?" "Yeah." He goes, "What are you, nuts?" I said, but Chief, I love to ref. He goes, fine. You're doing okay right now. He goes, you're doing fine. You're traveling weekends with the independents. You're working with us. Because in those days, they could not use their own referees. They had to use state officials. They could not use their own referees.
Why did they have to use state officials?
Because it was considered on a par with boxing.
Mm-hmm.
And the state, of course, got a percentage off the top of the gate. And what happened was you had to be licensed by New York State. And back in 82, when I started, there weren't many people that wanted to be wrestling referees, you know. And I had – you must hate me for doing this.
But brother, you are fine.
At any rate, I would say we were talking about they had to use state officials. It was on a par with boxing, and they were state jobs. And of course, the Garden and Coliseum and other places paid quite well. And I didn't realize I was very naive. I don't know if I could tell you how I got into refereeing, but it's kind of a unique story. Probably most more unique than any other referee. I was watching wrestling on TV with a bunch of friends. I said, boy, that referee's done a terrible job. He goes, yeah, you could do a better job. I go, probably. So, well, why don't you? So I said, you know, maybe I will. So the next day I looked all over for the WWF phone number. There was no internet in those days. So obviously I couldn't, find a number. I finally found Capital Wrestling. So I call up Capital Wrestling 26th time. Nobody answers. The 27th time, I get this guy on the phone that made Marlon Brando and The Godfather sound like a choir boy. He goes, I said, is this the office of Capital Wrestling? Who wants to know? I said, my name's David. What do you want? I said, well, I'd like to be a referee with your organization. We don't need any. I said, can I send you a resume? Don't send me any gifts. It's still no. Hung up. I said, well, that went well. Today, not to be disappointed or discouraged, I go and I try to find your physical address. And because I was a man on a mission at this point, I said, I got to do this. I really want to do this. So I found out that their office was located at such and such in Midtown Manhattan. Well, I was working at the Trade Center at the time. And I would pop up every day to the Holland Hotel, not knowing it was a front. So I'm there for 2 weeks straight at lunchtime. And finally, the doorman comes out and he goes, excuse me, are you a cop, a private eye, a stalker, or just a nut? And I said, I'm looking for somebody from the WWF. And he goes, they're here once a month for the Garden for a few days. Get lost or I'll have you arrested for stalking. So I said, well, this is not looking good. I don't know if this is going to work. So I ended up being the master of ceremonies at our church's 100th anniversary. And there's a guy there connected with boxing and wrestling. And I said, do you know how I could get a license to referee wrestling? He goes, come to my office tomorrow. Well, I drove up and down Central Avenue in Yonkers. His office turned out to be a hot dog truck. So I mean, this sounds like a Woody Allen movie. I know, excuse me. But so I go in a hot dog truck. And he says, you're going to be licensed by New York State. I said, well, how do I get a license? He said, well, what you're going to do is I'm going to get a couple of politicians to recommend you to the State Athletic Commission. And because you were an athletic director and a coach, they'll probably consider you. So he does. He sends it in. I apply. They sent me an application, a $50 check they want, non-refundable. And 2 weeks later, a license appears. I'm licensed now to referee in New York State.
Just like that.
What?
Just like that.
Well, I'm licensed. They never call me to work. But this isn't going to work. So I'm right around the corner at the Trade Center from their office. So I walk over to your office and I said, I'd like to work. You gave me a license. Let me work. And the guy goes, oh, we'll call you soon. Well, his definition of soon was not mine because 2 months went by. So I go back and I do what Mickey, the hot dog man, told me, go in his face and say you want to talk to the boss. Well, I start yelling with him and the boss comes out. Jack Prendeville, and he says, what's the problem? And I talked to him, and he says, all right, we'll give you a shot. So 2 weeks later, he says, you're going to work at the Westchester County Center in front of 5,000 people. Now, I never stepped foot in a ring, never talked to a wrestler. I had no idea if it was fake or real. I'm going, could I get hurt if they don't like me? So I went down to Blockbuster Video and took out every VHS tape I could find on wrestling known to mankind, and got home from work at 6 and stayed up to 1 watching the referee. So finally the day comes, right? And I go over to the county center, and in charge of the show is Arnold Skolin, whom I had met locally several times and talked wrestling with. And he says, Dave, it's getting a little late. You better go up and talk to Rods. Now, my first match was Johnny Rods against 21-year-old Eddie Gilbert. And Skolin says, you better go up and talk to Rods. So I'm walking up the stairs to the Heels locker room, and I'm going, all right, talk about the weather. How's the family, Johnny? Is wrestling real? So fortunately, Johnny Rods was anything but a heel. He helped me out through the first match. He called it our match. He got me involved. He wanted me to push him. I disqualified him. I threatened him with a fine from the commission. People were going wild. They were cheering for me because I got in his face. And if I hadn't had Johnny in my first match, I wouldn't be here tonight. He was just phenomenal. And he got me through the first match. And then I'll talk a little bit later on in the independent circuit. The first independent I traveled with, Johnny was their booker, and he continued my education. But that's how I got involved in the business. And I don't know if there are too many referees that could tell that kind of a story.
Now, you talk about your education. What was it like learning? Because, you know, now if I wanted to learn wrestling terms, you know, the behind the scene terms, the jabroni, the jobber, you know, putting somebody over, all these terms that over years I learned it, or you picked up a magazine, you had to pick up like Pro Wrestler magazine or something like that. And maybe somebody would tell you a little bit of the behind the scenes. What was it like in 1982 walking in and hearing these terms and trying to figure out what the hell are they talking about with me right now?
Well, one of the things I think that saved me is very early on, I realized no one ever bought a ticket to see me. Okay. You didn't buy a ticket to see Dave Dwinell.
What?
It may be my mother, but she hated wrestling. She said, how could you work with silly fools? And what happened was, I realized early on, if I wanted to stick around, I had to work with these guys, and I had to make, my job was to make them look good. So I kind of located, I kind of worked very, very hard to make them look good. I would work with them. I would ask them constantly questions. I was constantly learning. And I think they respected me because I didn't come in and say, hey, I'm a state commission member. I'm the referee. You better do it. I mean, the old referee I worked with on my first few shows told me, if they ever touch you, you disqualify them on the spot.
Really?
And I'm going, because they thought it was boxing. And I'm going, oh, I don't think so. That's not what I saw in the films, you know, but that was back, like I say, in the early 80s. But basically, I just lost sight of what was.
Well, I was just talking about all the different terminology, like how you learn the terms.
I never got too much totally into that because I was more concerned about not screwing up on a match. The last thing a referee wants to do is screw up. I mean, some referees have screwed up back in the early days where wrestlers got him in a corner, held him, and broke his arm.
Oh, wow.
Because he got in their way. He screwed up the match. He didn't. So I was very much into, I'm not going to screw up the match. I want to make sure I know everything that's going on. When you're in a ring, especially some of the rings are small, you have to know where to stand so you're not in their way, so you don't get hit. I mean, I used to, when a guy would be punching a guy, I would always come in from the left until one night a guy was left-handed, almost took my jaw off because he came back with the elbow. So, you know, it is a certain amount of things you have to do. And plus, you're using muscles that are not normally used. I mean, my first match, I had, in those days, the ring was not like it is today. It was canvas and tied at the end. So I had mat burns on both my knees for about 2 weeks after the first match. So I went out and got huge wrestling knee pads to wear under my black pants, which people don't realize that, you know, because I used to like to slide a lot. I used to like to get down on my knees, bounce around. Johnny had told me, people in the balcony don't know what you're talking about. So if you're in a corner, wrestler's choking another wrestler in the corner, you can go like this. You can't do that because you want people upstairs to know guys choking them and it's not allowed. So there was a lot of hand gestures, and I would come up with things. I would come up with sayings like, if he was punching a man, I'd say, hey, listen, this ain't boxing. What are you doing? Or if he's kicking him, I'd say, this ain't football. What are you doing? Or if he's choking him, I'd say, you're choking a man. No, I'm not choking him. I said, then what do you do? Giving him a throat massage, you know? So I would come up with things like that but it was a lot looser in those days. The wrestlers weren't under the pressure they're under today. It was a lot looser. They'd even change finishes on a ring. I used to do fair shows, and it would be Doink the Clown against Scott Bigelow, Bam Bam Bigelow.
Bam Bam Bigelow.
They changed the damn finish on me. They tell me one finish, and then they do another one.
Well, now that's a great question right there. And I'll answer Anthony's question of how does the state or how/did the state get away with regulating the use of referees for a predetermined match? Because it's the state, Anthony.
They didn't know it was predetermined in those days.
Oh, so that wasn't even part of the conversation back
then. No, nobody knew it was predetermined in those days. Kayfabe, if it ever got out, there were no wrestling websites. Podcast, it was all kayfabe. The only people that showed up at wrestling shows when I first started in the 80s were blue collar workers, middle class blue collar workers, and white collar closet fans who would never let on that they were at a wrestling show.
Oh, really?
And there weren't a lot of kids there. I mean, you'd walk out of the locker room and you couldn't see the ring. There was so much smoke, and everybody was drinking. This is back in the very early 80s, at least a lot of the places I worked. And we're talking WWF now. And I can give you an example one night of people believing what they saw was real, if I could mention. I hope I'm not talking.
No, you're good. No, please.
It was the Iron Sheik and Volkov, the Foreign Express, who had just lost the title to Wyndham and Rotundo, the American Express. Okay? And it's a very cold evening, 5,000 people in the White Plains County Center. It's a tag team championship match. They got the doors open. It's a freezing outside. They got all the doors open. People are standing in the street. People are standing on the sidewalk waving American flags. And of course, Volkov and the Sheik are in the ring. Volkov starts singing the Russian national anthem, and the Sheik is spitting on people, going, "You're terrible Americans." Well, you've got 5,000 men drinking and smoking. And it started. I had size D flashlight batteries going by my head from people in the balcony.
Oh, shit.
I got hit with 3 or 4 canisters, plastic canisters of beer in the chest, in the face, in the back. I looked down. I felt something hit my wrestling boot. It was a dart sticking out of my wrestling boot. People were throwing darts. And the faces weren't even in the ring at this time. So, what happened was, it got very dangerous. It was supposed to be a 20-minute match. So finally the faces came in a ring, and I got in the middle of the ring, and I had garbage up to my ankles. I couldn't even walk in a ring. I said, maybe we shouldn't go 20 minutes. It might be kind of long. So I said, how about maybe we go 5 minutes? And they did. They went about 5 or 6 minutes, and Wyndham and Rotundo went over, and the place went wild. But again, you're talking kayfabe in full swing, and you're talking people who believed it. So in those days, like I say, it wasn't the WWF that you know today. It was a very almost primitive WWF, if you want. Would the WWF appear in a high school today? I don't think so.
Oh, God, no.
No, but I mean, in those days, they appeared in a lot of high schools. So it was a different time, a different place. And there were state officials being used because Vince didn't say, and that's how Vince finally got rid of us as state officials. In 2000, he said, this is all predetermined. It's a show. sorry, guys, you're gone. Changed Fortunately for me, pardon?
He changed it to sports entertainment.
Right. And he said it's all pre-subscribed, and he completely did away with kayfabe, so, and state officials. But that was okay with me because I was working for four or five independents, getting a lot of work. NEW, Mike Lombardi in particular. I was his first real referee. I used to do all his matches when he started. I do 6, 7, 8 matches. And I worked with him for probably 15 years. And just a wonderful guy to work with. I work with the United States Wrestling Federation, which Bob and Kathy Bailey ran. I worked for Mark Tendler, who ran shows in Long Island. I worked. I was actually featured on Mick Foley's biography in one of his early matches, where it was a handheld camera, and it was in Long Island, and I remember that at a high school, and he was wrestling as Jack Foley, and it was a tag team match, and I actually had a clip of me in a biography, which I would love to get a copy of that video, but I think it was either a family member or a friend that probably did it for him. So I worked for NCW, the original Northeast Championship Wrestling, Tommy Jeanette. We did a tremendous amount of fair shows. We did 15 fair shows in the summer, and I did the first matches on these fair shows of Taz, Tommy Dreamer, Bill Humongous, I forget his last name right now. He wrestled as Humongous and a few other people. Big Sweet William. He worked for the WWF. And a lot of those guys. Armin Cesarius, he wrestled as Kid USA. Misty Blue Sims and all her group. And, of course, the midgets. And if I could, I'd like to just tell one funny story that took place. First time I worked with the midgets. It was a guy who played Dink the Clown. I can't remember who he wrestled as.
Dunk. He had Dink and Dunk back in the day.
Yeah, well, he was the original Dink the Clown, but Tiger Jackson. It was Tiger Jackson against Little Louie, and it was one spot where Tiger Jackson would get thrown off of Louie, and I would catch him and throw him back on for the pin. And then I'd catch him a second time and throw him back on with the pin. And the third time, I was supposed to throw him off to the side easily, and he'd get really angry at me. Well, I guess I threw him too high and too hard, and he landed on the family jewels. So he turns over, and he's holding them in his groin area, and he goes, "God damn, ref, easy with midgets, please."
Holy crap. I have an old boss that would love that story.
I mean, I had about 15 spots I had to work with them. And they used to drive me crazy. They would play with me. They'd work with me. It was just total mayhem. And the kids, of course, at the fairs loved it. And then with Misty Blue Sims, who was the had about 7 or 8 girls in her stable of wrestlers would work. And we had one spot called the Honeymoon Move, where the heel would get thrown off of Misty, and I would roll over, and she'd land on me face down. Oh, and then she'd jump off me screaming, and I would sit up in the middle of the ring with a big smile on my face. And everybody, so we did things in those days that were just a lot of fun. But as I tell people, we were eventually replaced on the fair circuit by the Dancing Pigs, the Racing Pigs, because they put on 5 shows a day and didn't need locker rooms or showers. So we had
to. But those fair shows were drunk in the back room, couldn't make it out or something like that. None of those issues happened.
Those fair shows were unbelievable. We'd go upstate. We would go way up, almost the Canadian border.
Off Plattsburgh, Malone.
Watertown, further up than Watertown. I forget right. The name of some of these places. There'd be one horse towns, and the only thing would be the fair. And I will never forget guys like one of the wrestlers, one of the heels would always get on the microphone and go, just to get the people into a frenzy. Skull Von Kruss would go get on a microphone and go, "I'd like to know why all you people in the audience look alike."
Oh God.
Or he'd say, you know what you get when you get a full room of people from Watertown here, a full set of teeth. And he'd go, I don't want to say your people are dumb, but I saw a sign at the garage that said clean restroom. And I saw somebody go in and start cleaning the restroom.
Just pile them all up.
Oh my God, these people would go crazy. So it was just a different time, a different place. So we had people on these indie shows that did those things, like Snooker, Bill Leedy, Bonafide Stars, Slaughter, The Sheik, Volkoff. They weren't like indie shows. They were like supercharged indie shows, and they were just a lot of fun at the fairs. We had a ball.
So you're doing this for all these years. You got these opportunities to be with legends. We talked before the show about my personal favorite wrestler of all time, Hands of Stone, Ronnie Garvin. And you were going to tell me the story of why Ronnie almost put them hands on you, though.
Well, I have a picture from one of the magazines, and I shared it with a couple of people recently. I forgot I had it, but when I heard Ronnie was coming to the International Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame, we have to talk about that in a few minutes.
Yes.
I don't know if it was a Coliseum or the Garden, but Ronnie, in the picture, has his two hands up like this, ready to punch me. And I have my two hands up like this going, no, I don't think I want to take one of your punches, especially from the former NWA champion. And I don't know why. Maybe I disqualified him. Maybe I did something that ticked him off. Maybe because I used to give a lot of heat to the heels. I didn't care who they were or the faces. And it's a great picture. And I shared it with Seth and a few other people. And I'll show it to Ronnie. I want to show it to Ronnie at the International Hall of Fame dinner, which is coming up.
And that's coming up here. That's the weekend of August 27th, 28th, 29th.
Right.
Unfortunately, and it's sad to say, it was just announced, and I don't know what the other new announcement is, but the match isn't happening at the Dome in Watervliet.
Right.
But I do know that I don't know if it's going to be the next day or exactly what the whole process is going to be. I've still got to talk to Seth Turner, Mike Latuno, or the announcer. I love this. I don't know if you know this. The announcer, Mike, and I'll get Mike's last name wrong, Falvo, I think is how you pronounce it. He's our announcer. He's also, I just recently found out, we have now in Albany a indoor box lacrosse team, which I have season tickets to. He's going to be the announcer at the stadium for the indoor box lacrosse team also.
Oh, wonderful.
So there's a lot of tie-ins there, but we've got that coming up.
Did you freeze up?
Who?
You're freezing up a little?
I'm not.
Just for a second, but not now.
Okay.
Okay, you're good.
Ronnie's gonna be there. I just saw.
They just signed Tito, by the way.
I just saw that. Tito Santana's going to be there. I mean, these guys, again, for a kid who was watching in the early 80s through the 90s, and I even, I was telling my best friend Ken that in the probably, I'd say the late 90s, when it really had gotten, like, WWF was still in existence. It hadn't switched letters yet, and they had really fully – they had the best storylines back then. And this thing that's coming up that Seth and them have put on for this International Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame, you were involved. I know you said before the show, I wasn't a big name. I wasn't a big referee. I'm sorry. You told me you did Hunter Hearst Helmsley, Triple H's. Was it his first ever
match in Madison Square Garden? It was not televised, and about 2 weeks later, they did it again in the Garden for the Superstars of Wrestling or something. So that must have been a warm-up match. It was against Duke the Dumpster Drosy, because I remember I almost got hit. He threw the garbage pail in a ring and almost hit me with it. But I did. But I wanted to mention, if I could go back for a second, I'm excited that the original Rock and Roll Express are coming. Ricky Morton, and Robbie Gibson. From what I understand, they're going to be there. I did a tour in Germany with them at one point in time for one of the local NWAs. And I also did a match against the Samoan SWAT team with them. And I had a couple ribs injured because one of them was down for the pin and the other one dropped. I think Morton drop kicked. I don't know if it was Umaga who before he became Umaga and it was Samu. He was supposed to fall near me and knock me out. He fell on my back.
Ooh.
And bruised a few ribs. So I go back a little ways with the Rock and Roll Express. They're great. And they were 9 times NWA tag team. Did you know that?
I didn't know that many times. I know who they were, the Rock and Roll Express. Absolutely. Again, I remember.
Great matches with the Four Horsemen. You know, and of course, J.J. Dillon's going to be there, who managed the Four Horsemen. And I actually did him in a match against the Italian Stallion. So they're going to have some wonderful people there. And then the first night on Friday, they're going to have Bill Apter, the Notice Historian, is going to do an after session. Saturday, they've got lined up meet and greet. They're going to have autographs and photos and from 3 to 6, I think, something like that. And I'll be there, I guess, selling the book, and anybody who wants to come over and talk to me about some of the class of their favorite wrestlers back from then, on a story or two, I'll be more than happy to share one with them. And let's see, they're going to have a panel discussion with some of the wrestlers, and they're going to have the big inaugural ball later in the evening where they're going to make the presentations of the, and they're going to announce who's being inducted as the first class, and it ends off Sunday morning with a breakfast. So going to be a fun-filled weekend. I'm looking forward to making some contact with people like Bill I haven't seen in a long time, and it should be a lot of fun.
See, I think it's going to – it's just – like I said, I think it's going to be like a kid in a candy store, just some of these legends that are going to be there, faces that, you know, we haven't seen, you know, haven't been in rings in at least a decade, mm-hmm. but are – for a lot of us, they created childhood memories. You watch those matches, like the original Hawk and Animal, the Road Warriors. Oh, I can remember being a kid and watching those matches and seeing these inhumanly large, muscle-bound, face-painted, spiked football pad guys. And we would make up stories. I think they've killed somebody with it. They could kill somebody. They're going to kill somebody with those.
Well, I worked with them. I worked with them several times. And the first time I worked with them, they were doing some kind of a taping. It was right before they went to the NWA. They started with the AWA, if I'm correct, and then they went to the NWA. It was right before they went to the NWA. They were wrestling these two masked guys called the Red Demons or Demons or something. And they weren't very big. Now, the Road Warriors hit the ring, and I was never more impressed with an entrance than with them. And I consider them, and I don't want to knock any other tag teams, but I consider them probably the greatest tag team I've ever worked with. And the Red Demons came out, and they didn't want to get in a ring. Serious. They did not want to get in a ring. And they're arguing about which one of them is going to get in a ring. And these guys are getting hot. And they go, and ref, ring the bell. I rang the bell. They wouldn't get in a ring. Ref, get out there and throw one of them in a ring if you have to. I said, well, I can't do that. They said, yes, you can. So one of them came in a ring. He took 2 or 3 major bumps and ran out of the ring. So I think it was Animal looks out at these guys and goes, you don't come in this ring. We're coming out there. We're going to take those masks off and shove them down your throat. So I go, I think these guys are getting pissed off. I think you may want to come in the ring. And so they came in the ring, and they went home in about 4 minutes. And the Road Warriors were pretty pissed. And fortunately, the next time I worked with them, the match lasted a long. See, I don't think they just wanted me to count them out, or they just wanted to flatten them, because the people wanted to see them work. But these guys, I mean, I would have been afraid to see what the expression. It's a good thing they had masks on. I would have been afraid to see what their expression was under the masks. You know, they must have been, scared. And I mean, I can't kind of blame them in a way. I mean, these guys were like bigger than life.
Oh, they were monsters. They were monsters. But now you we kind of touched on Road Warrior for a second. I do want to roll. I know we're all over the place, but this is my how it is on my show, is we're all over the place. Did you ever ref any of the matches when, and I found this out by watching the Road Warrior documentary. Mm-hmm. I never knew that him and Sting were like really super close friends that got into the business together. They were tag team partners. Did you ever do any of their matches where they were tag team partners?
Who, the Road Warriors?
No, Sting and Ultimate Warrior were when they were.
No, I did not. I did Sting with Jimmy Garvin at a bunkhouse brawl against the Sheep Herders. And Sting was probably had not been in. He still had the blonde crew cut and a little bit of face paint on. And, it was a dark match at the Nassau Coliseum, and I got the dark match. But it showed up for a while on YouTube, and I kind of caught that, and it was kind of cool to watch it again. You had the Sheep Herders, and you had Sting and Jimmy Garvin. And it was an interesting. It was the first match of the evening. It was a dark match, and unfortunately, it was on a Sunday. It was on an afternoon show because Vince had booked on top of them in the evening. They put the Bunkhouse Brawl on. Vince booked on top of them, so they had to change it at the last minute till afternoon. And unfortunately, it didn't draw very well. There was a battle royal, I believe, that afternoon in a cage, or something like that, or somebody was in a cage. I don't remember exactly, but I only worked with Sting a few times, and I only worked with the Warrior a few times, because what happened was, with me, I call myself the Alpha and the Omega ref, the beginning and the end. I always got the guys when they came in, okay? Dick Kroll, Jack Lotz, some of the bigger, Dick Worley, a lot of those guys got all the main guys. And in those days, Dick Kroll especially, he was very close to Vince Senior and Junior. And they would trust him with the big matches because they wanted to make sure, like, somebody from another league didn't call me and say, hey, make this guy go over. So I would get the newcomers in. I'd get newcomers like Kurt Hennig, Bret Hart, The Undertaker. I got the new guys because nobody knew who they were. Here, Hunter Hearst Helmsley. Nobody really knew who they were. Dave, you could do the – I used to get the first match of the Garden all the time, and I said, wow, they really want to start off with me with a bang. No. First match used to be the longest match of the evening, sometime 20-minute Broadway, and I said, let Dave work. So most of the matches I have on YouTube, but then they started working me to the middle of the card. I had Brutus Beefcake, One Man Gang. I had a great match on YouTube with Marty Jannetty against – Pat Tanaka, and even the brain came out and said, oh my God, this is a great match. I mean, it wasn't a rest hole for the 15 minutes they worked. And Bobby came out with one of his famous comments against me when the heel was getting beat up. Bobby goes, this ref couldn't make a good mole cop, you know? So he would come out with stuff like that. Or he'd say, that's the first thing he's seen this evening. Oh, ref saw his foot on the rope. He goes, what's the first thing he's seen this evening? But,
great, because even though he was a manager, he wasn't a wrestler. He was not afraid to take a bump. He would take a bump.
Right.
And I think that's what always sold him when you watched him, was he had the great lines. He was going to talk smack about everyone. And then he was so weaselly about it that he would run away, but they always got him. And he always took a bump, but he took it like a champ.
Right.
And went on with it. That's, you know, you never. I think the only other one I could think of that was like that was Hart. Jimmy Hart.
Jimmy Hart,
mouth,
yes.
Jimmy, mouth
was,
to the South.
Jimmy was good, yes.
He was another one willing to take a bump. So we've got this book, though. So I know you said you've got a few copies. There's digital copies out there. It's called Ring Man.
It's available on Amazon. It's available on Barnes & Noble. What the websites? It's available on a number of websites. If they go into Google and just Google Dave Dwinell Ringman, it'll come up on one of the – I tried to keep it as low as possible. The ebook is $5.99. The other book is the paperback is $14.99, which I think is reasonable for – it's 289 pages, 40 photographs. You know, and I wanted to make it affordable because it's dedicated to all wrestling fans of all ages and generations. That's who it's dedicated to. Because without fans, we have nothing. We were nothing without the fans.
That's awesome. So, you said you're going to bring copies with you to the internet.
Seth had asked me if I'd like to have a table. You know, would I like to have a table? I said, you know, why not? And you know, even if somebody doesn't want to buy the book, they can come over and they want to ask me a question about some of the wrestlers I worked with, or they have a favorite wrestler, or whatever. I'd welcome that, whether they buy the book or not. That's immaterial. And I'm going to put it at I believe I'll put it at like $11.99 instead of the $14.99 celebration of the IPWF. That day I'll make it a couple dollars cheaper than it normally goes for. And if they want to buy it, fine. If they don't, you know what? So be it. Again, I never considered myself a big name in the business. As a matter of fact, I did a few podcasts, and one of the guys says, to be honest with you, I don't know who the hell you were. But he goes, I read the book, and he goes, I loved it. It's not a biography about me. It's stories about, because people would always ask me, my friends, my relatives. Everybody would ask me, what was it like back then? Tell us some stories. Tell us about this guy. Tell us about that guy. Except there's that much interest. Maybe I should put a book together and tell these stories and tell, like I did with you tonight, how I got involved in the business. Some of the wacky things that happened on the independent shows. We didn't get in with Freddie Blassie, but Freddie Blassie was somebody I became very close to. And I worked in independent WWF with him in one of the worst sections of Brooklyn, Bedford Stuyvesant. And we're at a big old Catholic high school. And this is in a book, but this will give you an example of some of the stories in the book. He was the Ayatollah Blassie. Well, I always wanted to meet Freddie. And we found out we lived in the same town. We hit it off really good. And Freddie was always, he was never off stage. I'd say to Freddie, just to kind of piss him off, because he thought he was the toughest wrestler of all, I'd say, I heard Gorgeous George was a really good wrestler, even though, you know, he had kind of a fan. He didn't know the goddamn difference between a toenail and a toe hold. So we get in a ring, and Freddie's dressed as the Ayatollah, and he calls me over. He's got the cane and pretending he's going to hit me. So he calls, and he's dressed in the Bedouin stuff. So he goes, Jesus, Dave, look in the audience. The goddamn people are tougher looking than the wrestlers. And they were. And there's a guy, this is no lie, there's a guy 350 pounds or more sitting on two seats in the balcony. Freddie looks up. Now, we got paid according, the wrestlers and referees get paid according to the number of people in attendance. So if there were 50 people, we got minimum. There were 500, 5,000, 20,000. Freddie looks up and he goes, get back to the locker room after, and you tell Skolin to go up and make sure this guy bought two tickets, because one more ticket could put us into the next pay category. And with me, I said, Freddie, we'll be lucky if the goddamn balcony doesn't collapse. He goes, what the hell are we here? We ain't sitting under the balcony as long as we get paid. So these are the kind of conversations that went on in a ring prior to a match, when people thought he was going to hit me with the cane and told me to shut up and all of that. But we're really BSing about, BSing about kind of like what's going on in the arena. And I mean, you had guys like Butcher Paul, Vachon, and Sweet Hansen. And I had their match, and they were both kind of heels. And they Vince never put heels and heels together. So we got ready to go out, and I was annoying. I was pissing them off because I wanted to talk about the match in the locker room, and they just wanted to play cards. So they were trying to shoo me away. Get out of here, young guy. We don't want to talk to you. We're playing cards. So we go in the ring, and I guess to get back at me for bugging them in the locker room, they decide they're going to make me laugh. So throughout the match, there's one thing that's in the book, but I'm not going to say it here. It's a little bit suggestive. But they – well, I could say it without actually saying the word. Butcher was Swede was yelling at me. Butcher was yelling at me. He's pulling my hair, ref. He's pulling my hair. And I'm going, you're bald. You don't have any hair. And he goes, no, the hair on my, and he points down to his groin. And I'm going, I'm trying to not to break a smile. And I'll go, he didn't just say that, me in a ring. He did not just. And then they got in a cradle for like 5 minutes, and I had to go 1-2, 1-2, and I kept saying, "Is your hand red yet?" And I'm going, "Oh, these guys are going to kill me." And they tried for the whole match to get me to last. So we get back in the locker room, and they say, "You're pretty good out there, ref. You're a good guy. You didn't laugh." I said, "Well, it wasn't because you guys weren't funny. That's for sure." But it was a lot more fun those days. You know, today I can't blame the guys. They're getting paid big money. There's a lot of money involved. There's a lot of pressure on them. Back then, these were just guys. I went to a WWF show several years ago. And first of all, when I ref, nobody got in the locker room, refs and wrestlers. Well, it looked like Times Square in the locker room. And then they got soup to nuts, Perrier, Shrimp, just a spread that's unbelievable. And I was thinking back to when I used to work in some of these high schools and college gyms. We'd go there, WWF, we'd be sitting on a cold bench having a sandwich out of a brown paper bag and maybe a beer. And I'm saying, "Oh, time changed."
Well, I need everyone to know, again, the weekend of August 27th, make sure you're here in the greater Albany area at the Desmond Hotel. Come and see Dave. Get your copy of the book. He said it's going to be $11.99 on that day. I have a feeling that he will sign them.
Absolutely.
He'll get you a signed copy. Hear a good story. Hopefully we can get him and Hands of Stone, Ronnie Garvin, to reenact the famous photo with Dave having his hands up and Ronnie getting ready to put a two-piece on him. Well, if it was Ronnie, it was a one-piece because he was the original Hands of Stone there.
For sure.
Now, everybody, you told me you have a Facebook page they can find you on. If they have any questions, go on Facebook, look Dave up. Any other events, any other shows, or is it just this one that you got coming up, Dave?
Well, I did tape one with Carmen Despirito. I don't know if you know Carmine Despirito. He has a podcast, but unfortunately his partner he lived in Texas and a house got kind of flooded. And it's going to be a little while before that gets on. I did two with Wrestling Memories Now and Then. I did two with PWI with Mike Johnson. One with Dan and Benny in the ring, and they've invited me back. I did a couple European ones. People from Europe had called me and wanted to do podcasts. Some of them are available if you go to YouTube, or again if you Google my name. Some of these things will pop up. And it's been a lot of fun. I didn't realize how much interest there was in the classical golden era. What kind of turned me on to it was I was the referee in the famous or the infamous Heroes of Wrestling, the lowest tuned into pay-per-view of all times. I don't know if you...
No, I don't. I've never even heard of that.
Oh, thank God. And it was 20 years after. And that was the famous match where Neidhart and Bundy went against Roberts and Yokozuna. And it was out in Mississippi. And it's the only time in 32 years I ever went in a ring and I didn't know to finish because none of them wanted to take the pin. And this is a live pay-per-view.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it got a little bit hairy. And I was interviewed, how did it feel 20 years later? Well, what happened was we got in a ring, and I happened to be very friendly with Bundy. And I said, "Jesus," I said, "we got to do something." I said, "This match will go on forever." I said, "How about you throw me out of the ring and another referee can deal with it?" And he goes, "No, I'll take care of it." So he knocked Jake down, and he covered Jake. And they weren't the legal people in a ring, but I counted to three anyhow. And I realized that it's become like a cult following, and a lot of people. I got a lot of heat on websites because of the fact that I counted to three, and they weren't the legal men in the ring. But if I hadn't, I might still be there tonight refereeing that match. So you do what you have to. But there's a lot of stories in the book, and they're fun stories, and it's a fun book. Nobody gets thrown under the bus. Nobody gets thrown under the bus. It's not an expose of the business. I have no gripes with anyone in the business. This is good to me. I have the greatest respect for the wrestlers, whether they were preliminary wrestlers, independent wrestlers, or major stars. I have great respect for anybody who puts on the tights because there's always an element of danger when you get in a ring.
Well, it definitely – I can't wait till we get a chance to meet that weekend face-to-face. Hopefully everything works out, and we should be podcasting from there. Hopefully we get
awesome.
we'll get the podcast from the meet and greet. I got to figure that whole piece out. But again, folks, look Dave up. Again, Dave Dwindle, he's got the book Ringman. Take your time, read that book. Get your autographed copy that weekend. Also, if you have any questions, do you want to give your email? Yay, nay, it's up to you.
Probably not my email, but if they go on Facebook and they send me a message, I'll be glad to message them back.
There you go. Dave will answer your questions on Facebook about wrestling. My wife, she says, thank you, Dave.
I do have a secondary email that you could use.
Do you want to give that one out?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what that is. I don't use it too often, but I did put it down in the front of the book if anybody wanted to contact me.
All good. if you think about it, we'll put it on the above the bar.
I think it's Jules, JULESV 6688 at gmail.com.
So Jules.
Jules, JULESV 6688 at gmail.com. Do you want me to get it?
That's up to you. If you want to get it, if you send it to me, what we'll do is we'll post it on the Facebook page for the above.
Yeah, I'm almost positive it's that. And I opened that just in case fans wanted to, you know, contact me, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions about any wrestlers that they might want to ask about. And again, I look forward to meeting people on that weekend and touching base with people like Bill Apter. We started in the business about the same time, the early 80s, and I used to see him at almost all my shows back then.
And Bill, there's a story for those who don't know. He has all the down and dirty. He knows everything. He can find all the goods. He's kind of like the
encyclopedia of wrestling. He's right. Like the encyclopedia of wrestling.
He's got it all worked out. Well, look, folks, if you want to talk to us, you can always find us on Instagram at the Above the Bar Podcast. Our Twitter is at Above the Bar 4. Email the Above the Bar Podcast at gmail.com. As I always say, please like and share. Give the whatever you're listening to this on, subscribe away. Those subscriptions, push it to the top. That's how we get known. That's how we get found. I can't say thank you enough, Dave, for coming on a Saturday night. I know there's probably some match you could be refereeing right now. Somebody's waiting. Somebody needs you to put them over for tonight. Some heel needs to be put back in their place, because they're doing an eye gouge on somebody behind your back. But I know you've got them. I know you've got them in your sights, Dave. So you get the last word tonight, Dave. What's the last word for us?
The last word is thank you to all you fans for being so devoted to our sport and for making me be part of the timeline for 32 years. It's an experience I'll never forget.
Dave, I thank you. Don't log off after we go back to the green room. I got something for you. All righty, okay, folks. Be sure to push your stool in.
This has been an Earplug Podcast presentation. Found on earplugpodcast.com, iTunes, SoundCloud, and wherever your favorite podcasts are found.